Welcome to another edition of The 51%, Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. Life coaching, rebuilding relationships coaching, substance recovery coaching, eating disorder coaching, divorce coaching, just part of the services provided by my guest today, Natasha Silver Bell, who has been there, done that. Briefly, born and raised on a farm in the Midwest, Natasha struggled with undiagnosed learning disabilities. But despite those obstacles, she managed to become a star athlete, entered a local beauty pageant, and at 19, won Miss Michigan USA. Being selected in the top six of Miss USA led her to New York, where she worked as a Ford model. That glamorous, exciting time was also marked by an eating disorder and substance abuse. Natasha managed to turn things around during her first pregnancy at age 27. She had two more children, but then alcohol and drugs reared their ugly heads. In 2008, she took charge and, in her words, moved to the winning side. Natasha says she has a lasting sobriety and can be of service to others. And so today, Natasha, a divorced mother and former addict, is a certified addiction recovery coach who works with individuals to help them create healthy lifestyles, make positive choices, and find their authentic selves. Natasha, welcome, and thanks for joining me today.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
So you go from glamorous to the god-awful.
Yeah, pretty much.
Talk about that journey.
Well, I mean, it began, I had a beautiful childhood. I had loving parents, two older sisters, Christian upbringing, and it was beautiful. And I do believe that that upbringing really did help me sustain and find lasting recovery. To have that solid foundation.
I was just going to say a solid foundation.
A solid foundation is, of course, so important. Routine, rhythm, structure, discipline. Mm-hmm. You know, we grew up without a television in our home. We grew up Seventh-day Adventist, and I loved that form of religion. But I think with any religion, there comes a moment where, as a teenager, you're trying to find yourself, and you would like to choose the religion instead of saying, oh, is this the only thing that's out there?
Or you'd like to dump the religion and not choose another one.
Well, let me choose.
Okay.
And so maybe I didn't feel like I had the choice at the time.
Did you find that religion was way too restrictive for you?
Yes, as a young teenager, I think, and, you know, you enter beauty pageants, and which are really an external expression, but yet it really is on the inside. So it's a combination of both. But as a young teenage girl, how do you make
reconcile?
How do you make that distinction? You know, so
why did you enter beauty pageants?
I was 17, and in the southwest corner of Michigan, there's a beautiful, amazing festival called the Blossom Time Festival. It's the oldest and largest festival in Michigan, and each hometown has a pageant, and each of those winners of that hometown pageant go on to try out for Miss Blossom Time. It is such an amazing American tradition. It's so warm. I still go back and judge. It's just a blessing to have been a part of it. And so it was...
So it was a natural thing.
It was. It was just
right
there.
I mean, obviously, you're a very attractive woman. I mean, clearly, you have to have the looks to enter a pageant.
Well, let's just say at the time, you know, beauty's in the eye of the beholder. And at the time I entered the pageant, we had who could sell the most tickets. And she would win the Miss Entrepreneur title. Well, I was very motivated to sell tickets. And I remember my grandmother, she told me after the pageant, she leaned over to my sister and she said, oh, I hope she gets a ribbon. And I had won Miss Entrepreneur. I had sold the most tickets. So they were all very happy and satisfied that I'd got something and we were going to go
home
and
call
it a day.
You can walk away with your head held high.
And then I win the title and go on to win the next one and had a wonderful year.
So you were still in high school while that was going on?
I was a junior in high school.
And so you start with Miss Blossom. Blossom Time. And then you work your way up.
Well, you would think so, but no.
Oh.
The pageant ends there. There are a lot of pageants like that out there in the America system. And then modeling opportunities started to come at me. And school was hard.
It wasn't because you said you had learning disabilities.
I did. And in 1982, in second grade, that's when I was, you know, struggling to read. It was like, what is this? It's okay, so she learns at a different pace. And as your peers are turning tests in right away, and you're like, wait, I'm only on question five. I understood the content, but at the pace in which I could ingest the content was vastly different than my peers.
And nobody was there to hold your hand, so to speak?
Oh, sure. My parents were there, but, you know, a good little sweet girl who doesn't raise any problems in school and turns in her homework and gets okay scores on tests.
Do you think that the beauty pageants were in some way a compensation?
Absolutely.
Oh, Sandy, yeah. There's my knack for stating the obvious, that you can make your mark in another way.
I suppose so. And at the time, I had no idea that's what was happening. But it was much easier to stand on a stage and smile and communicate with an individual as I am with you versus let's write an essay about our reflections of the interview today.
Now, what about the athletic part of this, too? Because you were really into sports, right?
Yes.
And you were good.
Yes, another opportunity to help my self-esteem get measured up there. I was very athletic in high school. I was a star cross-country runner in track and on the equestrian team and played volleyball. There were many things I could do for myself. So I was a happy-go-lucky kid, but very insecure with my academic ability.
Which is so funny because if people were on the outside looking in, yeah. they would think, are you kidding? I mean, what has she got to complain about?
And I was a very good girl. I was quiet. I didn't cause any trouble, really. I had a few moments, but, you know, nothing out of the ordinary.
So when did the religion part sort of take hold with you when you were trying to find yourself? I mean, and how did that play a role in your life?
Well, I went to the local Seventh-day Adventist university, and that was wonderful, but in my sophomore year in college, I decided to try out for the Miss Michigan USA. I won and went on to Miss USA. We had to take off 2 weeks of college, so I had to take off a semester to go down to compete for the Miss USA in South Padre Island, Texas. And this is back in 1996.
Okay.
So I didn't go back to college when I was done. The modeling opportunities, the contracts, they were all there. And it was like, and I always wanted to finish. I wanted to be a high school education history and political science teacher because I can remember things extremely well. Just writing them down while I'm listening was always a challenge.
So you could put that on the back burner.
110%.
Now, here's the other thing. So you get out of Michigan. That had to have been exhilarating and at the same time overwhelming. How did your parents feel about you moving to New York?
Well,
even though you were over 18.
Let's say at the time I had a very clever way of communicating only what my parents needed to hear.
Well, that doesn't
as any
make
good
you unusual.
18, exactly. And I'm very on to. So when girls sit in my office and we talk about what they're really sharing with their parents,
you get it.
I get it. And we just help help them realize what they're doing at their pace.
So you come to New York on your own. Eileen Ford was notorious, right, for taking women under her wing and making sure that young women didn't go crazy in New York City. So that was comforting, I would have to think, to your parents as well as to you, no?
Right. Ford is a massive global
enterprise.
Agency. And at the time, this is back in 1998, 99, 2000. How could she possibly keep her eye on all the young ladies under her?
That's what the PR was, right?
I think there are thousands of women under Ford's agency boards, and it's just absolutely impossible.
So what happened to you in New York?
Well,
you were like a kid in a candy store?
I suppose that I was very naive and looked a certain way and didn't want to be taken as a naive girl. And, you know.
So you model for how long?
A long time. I mean, until even through some of my pregnancies, I modeled. But when I had my child, when I was pregnant at 26, you know, I was able to stop the insanity of drugs and alcohol and the fast-paced life that New York City.
So did that come relatively easily to you?
It was all glams. It was all everybody's talking a lot of stuff. There's a lot of talk and not a lot of follow-up. And that's up to the individual to take the action, and that's what makes a New Yorker, in my opinion. Are they willing to take that lead and run with it and not let go? Perseverance.
I guess it must be really hard when there's no background for this. You're kind of thrown from the frying pan into the fire, right?
But I suppose that looking back, I see that now, you know, 20 years since that moment.
Well, hindsight. Did you find that your behavior and what you lived through was kind of the norm rather than the exception?
It was the norm. It was absolutely the norm. And the designers were fabulous and they loved you. And, you know, you would go out with them and enjoy the lifestyle of all that, you know, fashion has to offer in the city. And as a young girl, if you don't have, you know, a coach or a big sister or
a mentor
or someone saying, hey, can you think about what you're going to do before you do it next time? And doesn't mean you're going to make the choices for them, but you're going to help them really think it through. And they still are going to need to make some mistakes, but hopefully they won't be as catastrophic or devastating. Or, you know, I lost my contract with Ford.
Because?
Because of drugs and alcohol.
How many years after you started working?
3.5 years.
Were you married at the time when you lost the contract?
No.
Okay. No. So then what the hell did you do?
You know, that's a really good question. I haven't really thought about what did I do after I left my contract. I was seeing someone at the time,
okay.
And we were in a relationship. And
you had a place to live.
I had a place to live. And, you know, I tried. I think I signed up with some other agencies. But, you know, I think then we got married.
Were you mostly a runway model or a photography model?
I was both.
Uh-huh.
I was both. Commercial and print.
Do you miss it?
No.
It's such an alien concept to me because, you know, I'm the antithesis of that. You know,
right.
Nobody sort of ever looked at me twice or, you know, in that sense. You know what I mean? So
right.
There's a sort of, in my case, an overdeveloped personality.
Mm.
But, I mean, you're a beautiful woman and it just seems like it's so easy and it's so
well, maybe that's why I love what I do so much now because, yes, I may look a certain way, but there's so much more content and information and my business is proving of that, that when you sit down with me, we're going to really get to work. And so to be valued for what I have to offer from the inside is beyond anything I could have imagined for myself.
When you lost your modeling contract, mm-hmm. did you ever entertain the thought that you'd go back home?
No, I mean, it wasn't a thought. I wasn't really thinking much at the age. I don't even remember what age it was.
Mm-hmm.
But I just remember I was thinking, oh, finally they fired me or finally they wouldn't renew my contract. I was waiting for it.
Huh.
Yeah.
What took him so long?
What took him so long?
Wow. If you're just joining us, my guest today is life coach, former model Natasha Silver Bell. So you were clearly unprepared for life in the fast lane.
Yes, 100. Yes. Who can never be prepared for life in the fast lane? And if they are, they're going to burn out before they hit the second lane.
And so when the modeling contract ended and you were involved in a relationship, so then you could kind of say to yourself, well, life is still okay. You know, I'm moving on to the next phase or not
really? I thought
really?
I would go just sign with another agency.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it wasn't really, whatever.
Well, explain to me what it means when you say moving to the winning side. What was your epiphany? What the hell happened to you to turn it around?
That means you let go. You stop fighting.
Stop fighting and acknowledge that you are where you are?
Well, for me, it was to acknowledge the drugs and alcohol. I kept thinking, the illusion of every alcoholic or addict is that one day,
yeah,
we're going to get this. I'm going to be able to drink or use appropriately.
Oh,
so
I can incorporate it in my life and live a successful life.
Yes, I'm going to get this. I'm going to have 2 drinks of wine at dinner and that will be it. And that never seems to be the case at the end of the night or the next morning.
So you thought that you could strike a balance?
Yes. Yes, don't we all think we can do this?
Of course.
I got this, no problem.
So you have your first baby,
mm-hmm.
and when does it start to fall apart for you?
When my desire to be thin and
post-pregnancy,
yes,
you mean?
Post-pregnancy weight, and
mm-hmm.
I wanted to be thin, and so, wait a second, how do I lose weight fast? Oh, diet pills.
Of course.
And diet pills are basically amphetamines. And amphetamines, you need something to come off of those. Otherwise, you're going to be an absolute disaster. And so comes in what we call benzos, Valium, Xanax, Vicodin, other forms of drugs that help you come off that edge
mm-hmm.
with a glass of wine.
Mm.
And now you have pills and alcohol combined together, which is deadly.
And who's making this so easy for you?
Oh, that's a whole nother conversation we'll have to do another show on.
Because that's
the
just such a
business.
The medical
community is unbelievable. And if you want something, you can get it on the internet. You've seen the 60-minute specials. You can go online and fudge numbers and age and all kinds of things to get what you want. But at the time, the internet wasn't really profound at
right.
the time.
Right.
I know what's going on now. I'm very, very in the know now. But you become friends with people who are pharmacists or are doctors and
I would imagine that's pretty easy in
yes,
terms
it
of,
is.
You know,
so people.
The means to the end.
So one of my slogans is by Rumi, a quote is, what you seek is seeking you. So if you're seeking drugs and alcohol, it's seeking you.
So this destroys your marriage?
Let's just say that there came a moment where I realized that I will be the kind of mother I need to be, not married.
Tell me how you really got involved in life coaching. Well, first of all, how long have you been doing this?
Professionally, about 3 years.
Okay.
And I've been working with women for about 5 years. And
meaning, what were you doing 2 years prior?
I was working with women pro bono, and I was just mentoring women because people would – it's interesting. When I sit down with a woman at a luncheon or with anyone, let's say I'm at a dinner party, and the person to my right turns to me and says, hi, how are you? What do you do? And you have that, you know, casual conversation. I can't help but – you know, go right to the core of who I am and what I do.
Mm-hmm.
I can talk fashion for a moment, but that's mm-hmm. about it. you'll only get a moment of fashion talk from me, and then we're going to go into, well, how does it make you feel when you wear that outfit? Or they'll ask me, oh, you help someone with recovery or substances, and then that person already has someone, you know, in their family or their friend or their loved one who's either passed away from the disease of drugs or alcohol or has someone that they're dealing with that they don't know how to deal with it. It's so foreign to most of us to know how to deal with someone who's using actively.
At what pivotal moment did you say to yourself, I have to help other people? Did you wake up one day and said, I'm going to be a life coach?
Well, I love working with other people. I mean, I always wanted to be a teacher.
Right.
And even in the beauty pageant world, it's all about service, charities, giving back. And as the Christian philosophy that I grew up with, it was, you know, missionaries. I mean, that's just the mentality I was raised with.
Mm-hmm.
So on top of that, one thing that helps me maintain my sobriety is working with other people who have substance and alcohol issues.
So it seemed to be a no-brainer in a sense.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't even think about it. It was just finding the courage to actually go, okay, you're right. I do need to do this professionally. When I had trained professionals, psychiatrists, psychologists, attorneys, close people in my life who I respected said, you're so good at this. I'm like, yeah, but I don't have a PhD. I don't have my master's in social work. I can't. They said, no. Just go get your life coaching certifications, and there's recovery coaching. Find your way, but don't just say no.
This is kind of a new phenomenon, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Life coaching.
What's the difference between therapists, psychologists, psychiatrists versus life coaches? Is basically therapists diagnose and treat.
Okay.
They deal with the past, which is great because I think we all need to work out some past issues at many times in our lives.
For sure.
So that's great. And I think that's wonderful. And I work with them. Life coaching takes the present moment, our strengths, builds on it, and moves forward to help us with life's challenges.
So how do I know I need a life coach?
I don't know. It's up to you. Come on in for a session and we'll figure it out.
Because I see that it's divided into so many different, you know, divorce coaching, eating disorder coaching. What's the difference between a divorce coach and a building a relationship coach? Isn't that basically the same thing?
People come to me because they're not getting anywhere in therapy with their partners or in their marriage or what have you. And they want to bounce it off basically a trained professional that says, we're going to help you really think this through.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to get a divorce? Okay, well, let's really talk about it. I have a wealth of knowledge and information about how we can explore what divorce would look like. What's really going to happen in your life? How's it really going to change? Because usually what I did when I was exploring those options is I would talk with somebody who'd been through it. They were a close friend.
When you were exploring options for yourself.
Correct.
Okay, and thinking what might work for
me. Right. So who's out there is safe, neutral person that we can go sometimes discreetly. I have a lot of clients that want to just see me discreetly.
For sure.
And then many who are you know, giving referrals left and right.
If you're coaching me and I'm not sure about my marriage,
mm-hmm.
are you seeing me and my husband?
I will,
how does that work?
I will talk with you about what options you would like to do moving forward. Who's ever sitting in my office is who I'm coaching. I'm not coaching the problems in their relationship. I am not a therapist. I know my boundaries. I know what I'm trained to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to go, oh, well, this, that, and the other. If I feel they need a good therapist, or usually people have seen a lot of therapists by the time they've come to me and said, I need a fresh person to help me gain new perspective on what's really going on here.
Create a scene for me.
Okay.
And I don't mean a scene for me. You know, go through what might be, I don't know if there's nothing so typical, but explain to me what would
really it comes down to. That is a very big question to answer.
I understand.
Really, it comes down to identifying with the person sitting in front of me what it is they really want in life.
Well, I guess I have difficulty trying to figure out what it means to rebuild relationships.
Okay, let's say a mother and a daughter.
Okay, let's do that.
Yeah.
Yes, something that can really be fraught.
Absolutely, and mother-daughter relationships
there's
a lot going on. As a teenage girl, I was very angry with my mother.
Mm-hmm.
Had no idea why. I think at 15, I love Wendy Mogul. She's the blessing of a skinned knee. She's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
I've gone to her lecture many times in Manhattan, and she says, at age 15, it's like somebody just snatches your daughter and takes her away. Someone just took my daughter. Where'd she go?
Right. Well, don't you hate your mother when you're 15?
Yes, that's
you know,
a general thing.
You may start to menstruate around 12, you know, whatever. And at 15, you hate your mother.
Right. So when I came out of that, I had to be an adult.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I help my clients, sometimes I'll see the mother and sometimes I'll see the daughter. Mm-hmm. I won't see both. I'll see one or the other. And occasionally one will come in per the daughter or the mother's request.
Mm-hmm.
And we talk about what's going on in the relationship. and how the other one can help see it maybe from a different perspective. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean they have to change their perspective. They have to be open to the possibility that the way their mother may view their behavior is different than the way they see their behavior.
Right.
And it doesn't mean it's something horrible. It's just, here I am, this neutral person that right. looks like me, saying, wait a second, could it be possible that your mother really has your best interest at heart when she wants you to come home at 10 o'clock every night? And when she says, but wait, Mom, no, I don't want you to do that, say, well, isn't it possible, Mom, that your daughter at 17 is saying, I think I can stay out till 11 or 12 now.
Trust me.
And I'll be responsible, and I'm really not up to anything bad, and if I am, I'm going to come to you.
Mm-hmm.
And just being open enough to have that healthy conversation with each other can create so much strength in a relationship, whether they're, you know, 40 and 17 or 25 and older.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is life coach, former model Natasha Silver Bell. Who do you tend to coach the most?
That is a tough question because my practice is growing so diversely. I would say women, young women in their 20s to 30s.
Is life just too hard for them in 2014?
I don't think life is too hard. It's just they're very excited about life. How do we move through these issues with relationships, with our coworkers? How do I, and if they don't have present mothers,
mm-hmm.
Who's there advising them?
Not their friends?
Well, maybe they're insightful enough to know that they need to move out of the circle of friends that they're in. Mm-hmm. And how do they even begin to do that?
I would imagine that to employ your services, that's not an inexpensive venture.
Yes, I think there are all different areas in which I coach financially.
Mm-hmm.
Initially started in the affluent world. Mm-hmm. And there were all different ranges from very high-powered executive women to women in their 20s and 30s who grew up in Manhattan and are now off on their own. And maybe they don't have a mother who's present, whether physically or she's here or she's not here. She's a other side of the globe. Who knows? And I'm not filling in the mother void. I make that very clear.
Right.
I am your coach. And you have to take each person's situation and their present perspective, mm-hmm. right? What's the essence of coaching or the essence of therapy? Meet your client where they are at. Mm-hmm. Where they're at emotionally isn't where they maybe want to be or should be. And that's why they're seeing me. And so to be really non-judgmental and kind and compassionate about what their perspective is and help give them opening that perspective window for them to possibly see things in a new light for the first time.
There must be, amid the successes, not the failures, that's not the mm-hmm. word, I mean, where you're just sort of thinking, you know, Mary Jane, you're not getting this, you know, and when is it that you know for both of you to cut your losses?
You know, what's interesting is by the time the individuals come to see me, they are ready to hear what I have to say.
Are they at their wits' end?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
I am not dealing with people. And if I do have a case that I have been asked to take by trained professionals and the person, you know, I'm working with doesn't want to hear what I have to say or isn't ready, then that is the toughest challenge. And I am under the liberty of the psychiatrist or psychologist I'm working in tandem with to continue with the case. And I'm happy to do it because you never know what you're going to say one day,
mm-hmm.
what life experiences they're going to go through that they may go, oh, that's it.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd have to be patient and kind because I know I didn't get it for a long time.
And you didn't get it with the help of somebody, did you? I mean, you kind of had to find your own way.
I restructured my social circle.
So you dropped people.
I had to.
Yeah.
The people I was choosing to surround myself with were not finding the best in me, nor were they encouraging me to put the drugs and the alcohol down. Doesn't mean that I don't blame anyone. You know that saying, if you have a finger pointing at someone else, you have three pointing back at yourself?
Actually, I didn't know that, I'll steal that.
Well, mm-hmm. you got it. And so I can point the finger in any different direction, as many of my clients do coming in the door. I get where they're coming from, but that doesn't change the fact that they are where they are and we have work to do.
What's the weaning process like?
An ideal way for me to be out of work, which is, of course, ideal, especially with my alcohol and addict clients, is 6 months. I have noticed that if someone's really ready, really ready, they can be in and out in 6 months and really have a good hold on sobriety.
Just for argument's sake, why would I see you and not go to AA?
I think that what's important is that I believe in AA strongly. Mm-hmm. I think 12-step programs are amazing. And if that is the right recovery format for you, run with it.
Right.
It is beautiful. Not everyone feels comfortable in a room with other people initially in their recovery, mm-hmm. and I offer a solution to that. So I get many people who are very frustrated with AA and haven't found it.
Are you on call for
me?
Yes,
yes.
So at 3 mm-hmm. o'clock
that's
in the morning.
That's what makes it work. Now, I have boundaries, and I'm also teaching my clients real-life circumstances. So when they text me at 3 in the morning and I am asleep and I don't see my phone, I'm not going to answer them until I wake up and I have a clear head to respond to them appropriately. And that also teaches them boundaries in the same moment.
Right. That's a good point. Mm-hmm. So you are now – you're in your own business. You have your own mm-hmm. business, and you're teaching other people to be life coaches?
Oh, that's a how did you know that? No, what's happening is life coaching, as you've said, and as we've noticed, it's just a different way of looking at helping people through with life challenges. Mm-hmm. And because I have established practice and am in the media now, mm-hmm. people are coming to me and saying, how did you do it? What did you do? And I send them in the right directions for their liking of whatever field of coaching they want to go into.
What else do you want to do for you in your professional life? Or are you really at a good spot and you're where you want to be?
I mean, obviously, I would love to continue with my practice.
And why wouldn't you?
Yeah, I mean, I love
it. It's a thriving practice.
It's a thriving, and unfortunately, it will always be there.
Right.
I think you have to be really careful about how you go about it. So staying connected with the trained psychiatrists and psychologists and or rehabs that I work with is really important to have a good ethical background, so to speak.
I think the thing that I wonder about in this day and age, is life just harder for women today? There are not enough women, you know, breaking the glass ceiling, or is it now that they are, the mm-hmm. pressures are even greater? I don't know where we are anymore when it comes to women, that we're still even discussing this.
And that's the power of life coaching in general, whether women or men, is that you need to settle down for 1 minute and find out what you really want. Stop thinking about what the idea
of having it all.
Of having it all. The idea of having it all is so relative. Having it all, what really people, especially Manhattanites, really want is peace in their own mind for their own day. From morning till night, they want to have that peaceful feeling without being drug-induced, whether prescribed or otherwise.
And how do you reach that nirvana if you've got a high-powered job, mm-hmm. you have to make money, you're raising your children? I mean, you can't have it all.
We go through all the tricks and trades that I do with my clients, and we explore all of the things that are fulfilling them emotionally. What does it feel like when you go to work? What does it feel like when you're with your kids? What does it feel like when you go to an exercise class? And that's how we identify what is bringing us peace.
Mm-hmm.
We really get in touch with what are our feelings trying to tell us? Our bodies have a lot to offer us.
And that maybe these are women, and I guess the majority of your clients are women, correct? Mm-hmm.
I can't say that anymore.
Really? So you, no. So you're getting phone calls from men?
Oh, yes.
What's the difference?
There is no difference. There really isn't.
Are they more honest? Less honest?
I'm not going to comment.
Okay. Okay. But is one easier to connect to? One gender easier to connect to?
No, they're identical to me.
And what about age? Runs the gamut?
The same.
Doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter.
And do you also counsel or life coach teenage girls?
Yes.
So you go
yes.
young to old.
Mm-hmm.
Are you feeling encouraged?
I'm optimistic about everything. I mean, I'm realistically—
That's a little annoying about
I
you.
I know. I can see that. I'm realistically optimistic. And you say cautiously optimistic. Well, I'm realistically optimistic.
That we can have it all?
No. I'm not going for all.
Okay. What are you going for?
Peace. To be able to breathe. At the end of the day, look into my children's eyes and really listen to what they have to say. And then find the energy to follow up with the emails after everybody's gone to sleep. That's a successful day for me.
And you have a lot of those?
Yes.
That's excellent. That's really great. So you're really at a good place. When you look back, did you ever think?
No, never.
Well, on that note, I was really thrilled to meet you, Natasha.
Thank
you. It's so interesting, and I wish you continued success.
Thank you.
Join us for another edition of The 51%, Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein.
Thanks for listening to The 51%, Conversations with Creative Women. For show comments and suggestions, please follow us on Twitter at Sandy Klein Show. You can also find us on Facebook at The 51% Conversations. The show is produced and recorded by Chad Dugatz at the Hangar Studios in New York City. Sandy Klein is our executive producer.